Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at the Yow West Conference in Perth, Western Australia, and great to have with me an old friend. We met, I think it was 2011 or something, in Salt Lake City, but he's finally back in his hometown of Perth. Paul Rayner, how are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Craig.
Yeah, was it Salt Lake City?
It was Salt Lake City. It was the Agile AATC, I think. I don't even remember what that stands for.
The Agile Alliance Testing something
Conference.
Yes.
And conference.
Yeah. They were good. I really enjoyed those.
Yeah, well, I just went for that. I flew into Salt Lake City, attended the UnConference the day before the Agile conference, and then flew back.
You didn't need to celebrate no 10th year of the manifesto?
No, none of that. It was just show up, and I like that format of just being able to get a bunch of peers, smart people together, and talk it through, that kind of stuff, and make connections, like meeting people.
Yeah, well, I mean, going to those conferences, and I've got them on my blog somewhere, but, that was where I've now met and kept in contact with people like Elizabeth Hendrickson and Lisa Crispin and Janet Gregory and all my rock stars from the testing world were all there.
Yeah, well, it's good because there are a lot of people that I know that I don't actually... like Lisa Crispin, for example, she lives in Denver, so I get to catch up with her for lunch every now and again, but... There are a lot of others that I don't actually get to see them until I attend a conference, right? So I've got friends in Denver that I meet at conferences out of the country because it's like it's just, making connections around the place.
Absolutely. So we're talking about old friends, but there's a whole bunch of people going, who is this guy? Who is Paul Rayner? Tell us a little bit. I mean, you're a West Australian, you're a Perth boy, you're back here at home, but as you said, you live in and lived in Denver now for... almost 15 years, I think.
About that.
Yeah, so how did you get into this whole Agile caper?
Well, that's a good question. So, when I first got into software development here in Perth, I was working for a company called MapTech, and we did mining software, and it really was a case of, as a software developer for this company, they would fly us out to a mine site, and we'd spend a whole week hanging out with geologists and geotechnical engineers, talking to them about what the software needed to do, and then we'd come back to the office, write it, fly back a couple of weeks later, and demo it. And so, even though it was C and Fortran, we were doing that whole thing of, let's actually sit down with the customers.
Sure, horror, talk to the customer, wow.
Right. And, that's early 90s, right? And then I ended up doing a lot of different development languages and stuff over the years, and ended up working for a company, I guess it was around 2007, where they weren't doing agile development. I was reading a lot about it. I was like, oh, this all sounds very familiar, and started going to some conferences, and I remember paying my own way to go to a conference called DevTeach in Vancouver at the end of 2007. Because a couple of guys that I'd read a lot of their stuff, they were teaching a class on behavior-driven development, and I was like, I really need to do this. So I paid my own way to go to the conference so I could go to their workshop, and I met a bunch of other people there that got me inspired about it, and so I really wanted to start taking it for further. So that was kind of an early introduction to BDD, and that was really around the time when people were doing fitness and that. And then over time, I got more into Cucumber and some of the tools around that. And the same project I was on in this company, we had a really complex business domain that we were working in. And so really struggling with that as the technical lead on that project until I read Eric Evans' book, Domain Driven Design. So it was like a whole bunch of things kind of started clicking for me around the same time, around sort of 2007, 2008. And I really latched onto those things and have tried to take them as far as I could and still keep that sort of integrative approach of, I'm not just a agile coach or I'm not just this, but I want to see how I can pull those things together and make them greater than just the sum of the parts.
So for those who, Eric Evans' book, Domain Driven Design, has been around
2004.
Yeah, and we've got Michael Feathers here as well at the conference, and again, his book has been around for about that same length. So they're concepts that were, I guess you'd even argue that weren't really in the agile domain, so to speak. They just matched what we were trying to do agile-wise.
Sure.
So I think a lot of people may not have even seen or read that book, or it's passed their way that it's been so long since it. Yeah. So is the whole community still alive and kicking in that space?
With domain-driven design? Yeah. I really think so. Early on with domain-driven design, I think there was a lot of excitement about it, particularly in Europe. And a lot of the ideas that it talks about, just in terms of how you structure an application to make the domain model primary, were things that in the Java community, in the .NET community, really made a difference, because people weren't thinking about applications that way. They were more thinking along the lines of just moving data around rather than actually trying to model the business. And so it really seemed to strike a chord with people, but there was a lot of focus on the technical patterns rather than the actual domain modeling and the stuff that I think is more at the heart of what domain-driven design is about, where you've got a complex business domain, you want to figure out how to deal with that complexity, and DDD, domain-driven design, says, so develop a rich domain model in the software that actually allows you to make that really difficult business problem something that's actually tractable, that you can work with and reason about in the code. And it talks about a whole bunch of practices for that. So I think recently, I mean, in January, I attended the first ever major domain-driven design conference in Brussels that was organized by the community there. And there have been conferences in London for domain-driven design every year. But we ended up with about 500 people in Brussels. It's just amazing to see that much interest. And I would love to see something like that in the United States. And I also want to see what I can do to help grow domain-driven design as a thing in Australia as well. And so that's part of coming out here, is seeing what kind of opportunities there are. And there's a lot of, even at this GAO conference, there's a lot of people doing interesting things. So how can I support them? How can I help raise the profile of these things and help people understand them better?
So what does domain-driven design look like, to your average development team member? Because I think sometimes it gets lost in the whole DD, ADD, BDD,
TDD. Yet another thing.
And so people go, I kind of do some tests first, and I kind of design my code. But there is a lot more to DDD than just that. So how do you know, or what benefits do you get, or do you see by going down the domain-driven path?
Well, there are definitely some situations where the types of practices that you would do if you're doing domain-driven design would be overkill, right? People that are working in fairly simple business domains probably could just build some kind of CRUD application using a very straightforward framework and do just fine. They're just moving data around. They're doing forms over data or something like that. And so they wouldn't need to do the types of things that you have to do when you're dealing with business processes that are complex and they're changing. I've done a lot of work coaching teams in recent years in retail and in financial and things like areas like that, where there's just a lot of complexity that you have to deal with as a developer. So with DDD, what you're doing is you're saying, well, in order to deal with that, you really need to be working closely with the people in the business that understand that complexity, and coming up with language, a shared language about what things mean, what those concepts in the business mean, and then representing those concepts in the code itself. And trying to make the code express that language and express those concepts in such a way that it's a natural fit between the code and the problem that you're trying to solve. And as you have insights about that, then you can, the code is easier to work with, it's easier to maintain. And the whole thing with domain-driven design, like I hear a lot of people say, well, design pays off in the long run. I think that kind of puts the emphasis in the wrong place. I think that if you do design well, it pays off immediately. There are dividends that it pays immediately, and also in the medium to long term as well. So I really see domain-driven design as, for the right, when you're trying to solve these kind of problems, you need to work closely with domain experts, you need to experiment and explore different ways of modeling that business domain, you need to think carefully about design and write the code in a disciplined kind of way, and use the patterns that are available to you. And you do that not because it's the right thing to do, but because it accelerates the delivery of the product and makes the product, the software product itself, something that you can maintain.
I guess by the way the code is then written and visible to you as a developer, makes it very easy then to have conversations, because you've modeled the exactly what the business have told you.
Yeah, exactly. So if someone in the business is talking about a certain concept, I can like let's say it's an order management system, and so they're talking about what it means for an order to be fulfilled, right? To go out to the distribution center, to the warehouse, and what are all the steps involved in that, and modeling that process to be able to look at the code and say, well, here's how it actually works, right? And see that language in the code of here's what it means for an order to be fulfilled, here's what kind of events get triggered as a result of that, and here's what happens in these other related subsystems. You can reason about this kind of code. The intention is clear. And if the process needs to change, then the code can change more easily because it's decoupled from the infrastructure and all the other supporting things that typically are kind of intermingled with the code itself.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So as you were speaking there about, I guess, getting the business domain there, and you mentioned it seems a very close overlap to behavior-driven design that you mentioned before, because you're essentially getting people together for the same reason. Mm-hmm. In order to tackle business problems, and essentially, I mean, Goyko Adzik, quite openly says that BDD and specification by example aren't a testing technique; they're a collaboration technique.
Yeah, and I would definitely agree with that. And I mean, I teach classes in both behavior-driven development BDD and also domain-driven design DDD, and there's a strong overlap. Like if you drew the Venn diagram of the skills and practices and techniques, then things like ubiquitous language, like having a common language, is part of that intersection between those two things, right? I mean, the idea of collaborating closely with the business to grow that language is part of that as well. And then, you know, I tend to approach behavior-driven development with a very strong DDD accent. So I'm always thinking about, well, how's the language that I'm using? What's the underlying model for that? And as I write scenarios in Cucumber or whatever, I'm using that as a test-first way of driving out my domain model and having those kind of conversations. If I try to express a scenario and I can't figure out why it's not working, then I can say, oh, well, maybe I need to talk to a domain expert or someone to figure out what this is, what this concept means, or something's missing. How do I do that? So very much a collaboration technique, and I think that's part of what draws me to both of those. Is I love that, you know, messiness of diving into a new area that that I have to learn and try and figure out how does the business work, how do we reconcile these different views of how this should happen and that kind of thing.
And you're giving the example in your keynote here at Yale West yesterday about, for example, in BDD, the given when then has a very close connotation to, I guess, modeling a domain or even even further than that, modeling events.
Yeah, one of the key ideas in domain-driven design is a good model is one that you can make assertions about, right? Not just assumptions, but actual assertions, to be able to say, within this particular context, for example, order management or something like that, I can make an assertion about what happens to when a certain command is processed for an order. Here are the events that are going to be generated as a result of that. Or here are the invariants. Here are the things that are always true about an order. And being able to make those kind of assertions is a key aspect of being able to reason about how the model works. And so it's a fundamental idea in domain-driven design. And then what I was talking about in the keynote was, if you're doing a system where it really is event-driven, then it's a very natural fit to be able to say, I've got this stream of events, and all the events that have occurred up to this certain point, well, those are my given. And then the action is the command that's being processed, and then what events are being generated as a result of that is the outcome, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a very natural fit in terms of thinking about how you do a test-first kind of approach when you are can make assertions like that.
So you talked about the intersection of DDD and BDD there before, and I can't recall it was probably about 2005 when I actually read the Domain-Driven Design book, and I can't recall in there whether it certainly talks about practices of collaboration, but from memory it doesn't tell you much about how to do it. So it's the real benefit of merging BDD and DDD together that a lot of the BDD practices do have more emphasis on the collaboration part, and then what you get out of the end of it is you get the software modeled in your domain plus the test that you get modeling your behavior. Is that the benefits of bringing those two together?
I think it's one of the benefits. I mean, Eric in the DDD book talks about doing domain-driven design in the context of an agile practice and particularly extreme programming at the time, which you know, Kent Beck talked about having on-site customers. So there's that assumption there that, well, we're working closely with the people in the business that are helping us figure out this problem. I think what I've noticed in the last few years is that there's been a welcome return to providing nice collaborative techniques that are accessible to teams. So the work that Jeff Patton has been doing for a long time with user story mapping is an example of that on the side of things where you're talking about what is the behavior of the system need to be from the user's perspective. Mm. So user story mapping is wonderful at that because it helps you avoid that kind of product backlog fatigue, right, where it's just I've just got an endless queue of stories that I have to work on, but I don't know how they relate to each other or what we're trying to solve. Whereas thinking about I'm going to build a visual map of the capabilities of this software and then and how they relate to the goals and needs of the user and combining that with personas, like that gets me excited because that's something that teams can actually visualize. And so on the domain-driven design side, like in my keynote last night, I see event storming as a very natural complement to that of thinking about the behavior of the system and, you know, what's the flow of events? What are the things that are happening? What are the commands that are happening? What are the interactions between the thing, the area that I'm working on and external systems? And being able to visualize that and do it in a way that's very engaging for people that are non-technical, right? Because it's one thing to say to a team, okay, you have to collaborate with the business. Well, how? Like, throw me a bone. Give me some tools that I can do that with. And so something like sticky notes on a wall or sticky notes on a long sheet of butcher's paper or something like that is a great way of saying, well, here's this tangible technique that you can practice and get better at, and it actually works really well. And so I think, you know, things like user story mapping, event storming, I now teach Matt Wynn's technique, example mapping. When I teach BDD, I'll be teaching that. I teach that in my public classes. Are just great ways to get people talking to each other, you know, and doing it in a way that's visual and tactile and trying to maximize their opportunity to actually have a shared understanding of what it is they're supposed to be doing.
So I want to take you back to that because I suspect a lot of our listeners haven't heard of Matt Wynn's mapping technique. Can you give us a quick overview of that for those who haven't heard of it?
Yeah, so Matt actually wrote a blog post. If you Google for example mapping, there's a great blog post where he goes through and describes it. But it's basically the idea that you know, in BDD there's the notion of we want to represent those three perspectives of developer, the business perspective or product perspective, and the tester perspective in terms of what's, you know, how are we going to verify that the system's doing what it should be doing. And so, you know, the three amigos idea. And so in an example mapping session, you want those three perspectives at a minimum represented, and you build up a visual map of like a yellow card is what's the feature or story that we're working on, and then green cards, you write on green cards what are examples of the kinds of acceptance criteria that we would have for this, and then you have blue cards for expressing the rules. So you might say something like in an e-commerce system, you might say, okay, so we're going to figure out how to apply a promotional discount to this particular shopping cart set of items. And so you might have a rule that says you need three items or more than $50 to get the promotional discount. And then you would write green cards for, okay, well, I'm going to add in an example where I'm going to add an item that's $30 and another one that's $20 and another one that's $30, and I'm applying this particular coupon code, what should the discount be? So that would be what you'd write on your green card. And the thing that's great about all these different techniques is that if you don't know the answer to a particular question, you don't try and solve it in the example mapping session. You write it on a pink card or you know, a bright red card or something like that. And then that becomes, just like in event storming, where you write questions on pink stickies, then you have a visual map of where's our ignorance? What don't we know? What do we need to follow up on? Man, there's a lot of pink cards, so we're not ready to even start this story right now. And what I love about that is the example mapping then allows you to do a very short structured conversation, you know, 20, 25 minutes max. It's very intense, but it's focusing on understanding what the actual problem is and what the acceptance criteria would
be
for this feature.
It's the Three Amigos conversation, right?
Exactly.
It's the three C's of the story card way back from the XP days. The card, which we have, which is our token for our for what we're going to do at some point.
Yep.
We promised to have a conversation, and what example mapping really gives you is the confirmation, and gives you a facilitated way to have the conversation.
And I think that's the key thing, right? Is and I say to teams, when you're first starting this, have someone that's the facilitator that can, make sure that you're writing things on the cards rather than just keeping them in your head, and you're building up on the table this visual map of your current understanding of the problem. So it gives you a nice structured way to have that Three Amigos conversation. And I like it as well because I see a lot of teams where they spend hours in these backlog grooming meetings just to come up with estimates, when they don't even really understand what it is that they're the problem that they're trying to solve. Whereas an example mapping session, like discovery workshop, would be what Koiko would call it, I guess, or a specification workshop, puts the focus on where's your understanding and where's your ignorance, rather than let's come up with a number.
Yeah.
Which isn't...
It's interesting in practice. I tend to use Goiko's discovery workshop more at the start of a set of sprints or iterations.
Yeah, where you're doing maybe impact mapping or something like that.
When it's something a little larger. And then what I really like about Matt's, and I've only just started using that, because I found I'd talk to people about Three Amigos in the conversation, but then that'd fall a little bit flat. When
they're all like, yeah,
we get it. And the nice thing about that is people often just want rules. And so it's a good starting point to go, here's some stickies, here's the rules of the game.
Exactly.
And they can kind of follow along, and then it just becomes natural. It's a nice stepping stone, I find.
I think that's what it is, right? I mean, I find it really helpful because people they think they know how to have these kind of conversations, but when it comes down to it, we do an example mapping session and they realize we don't know how to have these kind of conversations at all. We're down in the weeds trying to solve this problem when there's no one in the room that actually knows the answer.
Mm.
So being able to have a way of approaching that conversation without getting bogged down and, maybe having like one example mapping session a day right after the stand-up or something like that for 20 minutes for a story that's upcoming in the next sprint, or, what are the ones that we would most benefit from this kind of conversation, is a great way of practicing that, what Dan North and Liz Keogh talk about as deliberate discovery. Where's our ignorance? Let's intentionally go after that rather than just have conversations to talk about estimating things that they don't really understand.
Absolutely. So you mentioned event storming before, and that was what the topic of your keynote was here. And it's something I've been following. It's been out for at least a year or even more, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, Alberto came out with it in, I guess, 2012, 2013. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I must admit, I read it. I think I may even... I actually saw you flip the book up and I went... I'm sure I downloaded that at some point.
Off Lean Pub.
I think I read it. I kind of looked through it and went, maybe it's just another putting stickies on a note. But you did a great job in the keynote of explaining the whole process.
Mm,
so for those who are listening or haven't had a chance, we'll put a link to the slides for the few presentation and the video in our show notes. But what is event storming and what's making you so excited about it that you want to talk about it at the conferences?
Yeah, well, I've always, I guess it's come out in our conversation, is I've always been very, very interested in the technical aspects and also the soft skills as well. So really, I'm one of those people, I guess, that straddles the whole thing of wanting to be really good technically, but also wanting to bridge the gap between the technical side and the business side. And so I always gravitate towards techniques that help with that. So event storming, I find, is a great way of engaging the business people in that type of domain modeling that we're talking about by just talking about, like, mapping out on sticky notes what are the important things, the important events, the important facts, the things that are happening in the system to support the behavior that they want out of the system. So, what is the business process? Let's write all the different steps on stickies. Get a bunch of people in a room that are both technical and non-technical, that are each experts in their own area, and let's build a visual map, across the wall. One of the things I love about what Alberto Brandolini came up with is the idea of, let's put up a giant piece of butcher's paper on a wall, make it 15, 20 feet long. So you give yourself that notion of, wow, we've got an unlimited modeling space, and then just go crazy, right? Just model out as much of the business or process that you need to have that big picture of you know, what are we trying to do? What's the problem we're trying to solve? And really engage the business experts in that and talk through specific, concrete, realistic business examples so that it really is anchored in the actual problem space that, of what the business is doing. And the technical people can then be able to say, okay, well, now we need to drill into this particular area and go after that, and putting up pink stickies for things that you don't know or questions you have so that you can kind of see where the hot spots are in the model, because you really are building a visual model, like a visual representation of.
So you mentioned that the whole thing's predicated, I guess, on the rules of the coloured stickies you use. I mean, you can make your own legend, but I think is what some people sometimes get hung up on. But the idea is there's these different coloured stickies that represent different things.
Exactly.
And so what you start with is the business events.
Yeah. So those are typically like orange stickies. Sometimes I use yellow, but like you said, the sticky color doesn't matter so much as long as you're consistent. But orange stickies would be, you know, something like, you know, you might put the first one up, order fulfilled, and then you would say, okay, so everyone in the room has orange stickies and Sharpies, and they're all, and say, well, what happened before that? Oh, well, you know, before it was fulfilled, we had to go pick it from the warehouse and pick the different items. Okay, so let's put that up. You know, what would that look like? And let's actually use some examples of what those items might be. And then let's work our way backwards, right, through, so what caused us to get to this point, and what were the events before that? So, you know, it would be like starting with a story at the end of the story and then saying, okay, what are all the things that happened to get us to that point in the story? And
do you find people work backwards? Is that a far better way of building the map? Because I think human nature says you want to build forwards, right? So you go, what's the first thing that can happen, which can sometimes be a bit dangerous.
It is, because it automatically assumes that that first thing is the interesting thing, right? And it sets you on a certain path. And so I think that was one of Alberto's real insights, is that you often get a lot better results starting at somewhere towards the end and then saying, well, how did we get here, right? And the thing, I think the reason for that, at least what I've seen in my experience, is that what it does is it encourages the business people to tell a story. And that's really what we're after, is, you know, what was the narrative of how we got to this point? So one of the examples I use in my workshop is, okay, so this particular person, Bob, is a public library patron, and he has $97 in fines. How did that happen? And so it forces people to kind of, you know, and here are the rules for how you accrue fines. So how did he get here? And then now that we've mapped that out, well, how can we avoid that kind of situation happening? What would be an alternative story that we could tell? What would be a different flow of events that would actually produce a much better outcome? But we can kind of work backwards and imagine, well, here's... And if we had real domain experts, we would say, well, what really happened to get us to that point? And then in that stream of events, what were the key things that we could have changed or we could have tweaked? What would be alternate paths that we could explore? You know, where are the questions?
So do you find people get very tactile with it, that because, you know, sometimes you get very structured, go, this has to happen, then this has to happen, then this has to happen.
Yeah.
But when you stand back, you know, you see this process that you go, geez, that would take, you know, 48 hours to get through that process. How can we improve it? So do you find people then start to really look for parallels and parallel processing and perhaps different orders that might actually help accelerate the process?
Yeah, there's something, I think so. There's something really cool about actually putting it up there, putting the events up there, and then being able to reflect on it and see, well, that doesn't make sense. Why are we doing it that way? So there's an aspect of kind of value stream mapping. I mean, some people have actually used event storming as a way of kind of supporting something like a lean discipline, like, or lean practice,
so,
like value stream mapping.
I just want to say, Robin, that was my aha moment last night when I sat there, because that's what I do with, I call them as is and 2B maps.
Yeah.
But I sometimes have this this thing, I get the as is up, which is essentially the orange stickies.
Yeah.
And then I go through this process of putting the 2B up. But there's a bit of a structure that was missing in there. And my aha moment as I was sitting there last night, because I haven't really used this in anger, I sort of read it and went, yeah, that sounds like anything else. My aha moment was, I think I've just figured out how to come across my problem of moving from as is to be, or when I actually don't really want to do a proper value stream map, because the timing sometimes aren't the point at that, at that process. They can come out, and so you can actually translate that on there if you want to, but you don't have to if you don't want to. And it helps get the developers more involved, because you are talking about the events. So that was my aha moment. That was just as you said that, I went, that was my takeaway from the talk last night.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, there was someone that asked a question about, what if you want to compare like a as is with a 2B, how do you do that? And I did that in a workshop with a client last year, where they wanted to make changes to the way a certain algorithm worked. And so what we did was we said, okay, well, we're not changing the entire map for this area, we're just focusing on this one bit. So why don't we just put some blue painter's tape across that, leave the existing algorithm as it is, and let's just brainstorm what the new one needs to be right under that. And the beauty of that is then you can see both of them. And what they actually wanted to do was to implement both, and not even with a feature toggle, but actually over time be able to measure the performance of the new algorithm against the existing one by being able to direct some of the traffic through that new algorithm and run them both in parallel in production. So event storming allowed them to kind of see those things together. Other times I might say, well, what you're trying to do here is actually going to affect the entire flow of events, so why don't we just leave the current model up on the wall and start a completely new one on a different wall, and then compare them, right? This model that we have up here, to change the way that you're working, you're going to introduce some new concepts and some new aggregates or whatever. So why don't we do that on a completely different map and see where that takes us, and maybe try that, and then, oh, well, I think there's still some opportunity to explore this. Let's set up another map and let's do it again. Or sometimes we tear down the existing one and start afresh. So it's really about that whole thing of discovery and exploration, and trying to help people not get so locked into the current thinking about how things work.
The other thing that an event storming session gives you is it does start to map out what the product might start to look like, to actually start to visualize the design, which is obviously why it sort of fits so nicely in with DDD as well as event sourcing.
For sure.
So how does the map show that? Because a lot of the tactile things we use, story mapping, they kind of stop at the requirements phase to a certain extent. Whilst you're starting to visualize it, they don't quite get there, whereas event storming does actually help you start to map the model of
it. It really does. If you are taking... I mean, if you're writing an application that's really just a CRUD application, like your straight vanilla Rails, then it's not going to help that much, because you're not thinking in terms of events in that type of application. It's just forms over data. But if you are developing a rich domain model, even if it's your traditional layered architecture kind of domain model, it can really help. So you might do your event storming session, come up with a bunch of events, and then once you have that, so the first thing is coming up with the events, but then when you start to take it down to the level of design, you can reflect on that model and say, okay, so what we actually have here is this is an aggregate and it has a life cycle, and let's group these events together, and maybe all these events are concerned with an order and how it's being processed. So let's treat this as the order aggregate and actually use that. So that becomes something in the code. So if in your system you have, well, here's what an order is, then you can take those actual events and say, okay, these events actually represent steps in the order lifecycle. As an entity, it has a unique identity and a lifecycle of its changing over time. And so even in a traditional model where maybe it's not event sourced, you can still say, well, some of these events that we've mapped in our event storming session, we should represent those as events in our domain model, because then we can actually represent those significant changes as first class citizens. If you go the full route of event sourcing, then just about everything that you put up on that event storming model can potentially become something actually in your domain model, which is a very, very powerful technique, because it allows you to bridge the collaborative modeling that you're doing straight into the actual design itself, which is really, I think, at the heart of what you're trying to do with domain driven design, is to take this model, this conceptual model, visualize it, and then iterate over it and get it in the code, right? Get it in the as you know, Eric says, tackling complexity in the heart of software. So actually putting it in the heart of your software, that's where the model lives, right?
Yeah, it's awesome. So yeah, I think for those who are listening who haven't sort of delved into event storming before, the Lean Pub book by Alberto is really worth taking.
Yeah, Alberto Brandolini. We can put it in the show notes, but it's introducing event storming. It's still a work in progress, like a lot of things on Lean Pub, but there's a ton of great information in there. This really capturing kind of the state of the art in terms of this growing and evolving practice.
And the community's doing a pretty good job as well. I mean, there's a whole ton of blog posts out there of people who've tried.
Tons of blog posts. And it was funny because at the DDD Europe conference, it seemed like everywhere I turned around, there were people with orange stickies up on walls modeling stuff, because it's such an accessible kind of technique. Mm. So it's a great way to get people into thinking about domain-driven design without them having to worry about all the mechanics of the building block patterns like value objects and aggregates. They can just start thinking about, well, what's the behavior of my system in terms of events.
So what other things are, I guess, coming down the pipeline are piquing your interest in the Agile community or DDD, BDD space? Are there some things, some trends or just things you've been reading about that you're going, hey, I'm keeping an eye on that?
It's overwhelming. It really is overwhelming. I mean, I think back over the last year, like I tend to be pretty eclectic in my reading, and so like I took a class a year ago on coaching agile teams from Lisa Atkins Michael Spade,
we've had them on the podcast a couple of times.
Yeah, I mean, just great stuff, and I had read Lisa's book years ago, but it got me all excited about coaching. So then I started really digging into how do I make myself a more effective coach? Because a lot of what I do is coaching. I'll come in, I'll train a team in DDD or BDD, something like that. And then I want to be able to, you know, maybe come in a month later for a few days and help them work through whatever they're struggling with. And so how do I get better as a coach? How do I get better coaching one-on-one? And so, you know, reading books around that, and then, you know, because I have such eclectic tastes, like I read stuff on, like I'm very interested in Elixir as a language and playing around with that, and I don't know, it really is just overwhelming because there's so much going on.
Well, the languages, I think, are an important one, and I mean, we're obviously at a developer conference here, so we're kind of the odd guys out. But
right.
I mean, we were sitting now as a full-blown functional programming talk going on in a keynote.
Exactly.
But I think things like functional programming, things like quick check testing, these languages, say like Elixir and even Node, and I think it's starting to change the development cycle and really starting to accelerate. And so you have no chance, I guess, you have to be agile in order to make those things
you
happen.
You do. I mean, I think for me, I just want to keep learning, right? I mean, I started out in C and Fortran in the early 90s and then move over to Java when that came along, and then .NET in, you know, the early part of last decade, and then the last few years it's been Ruby, right? Yeah. And I guess I'm always, you know, interested in not only getting better at the language that I'm working in, but also how do I connect that with the other things that I know. So I spent the last 3 months part-time working with a team doing Ruby development in a major event source distributed system, and so, you know, dealing with millions of events coming in, and how do you deal with that level of big data, and then how do you deploy a system like that in a reliable way? How do you integrate that in with other systems? Just really interesting kind of areas. I love digging into those kinds of things. So I think part of the problem with being a jack of all trades is it's really hard when you ask a question like that. I find it incredibly difficult to answer because there's so many different things I'm interested in. I'm not a rock star at any of them, but I like to think that I can integrate them in ways that help people get a grip on them.
So the last question I want to ask you is, and it's just tweaked me of something I was going to ask earlier. Do you find any resistance when you come in and are trying to, sell's not the right word, but trying to coach people and things like DDD, BDD being in a kit bag? How do you deal with that when people sort of look at it and go, oh, that's going to add more overhead, or you know, why do I want to stand in front of a wall with a whole bunch of stickies? You know, that never worked for us last time. Yeah. How do you get teams to come on board with these concepts?
So, Oh, that's a big question. And it's funny because that exact question has come up at least two or three times in conversations that I've had with people at the conference. You know, when you introduce people to a new idea like event storming, that's the first thing they ask is, well, how am I going to convince people to do this, or event sourcing or whatever it happens to be? I think there's an article by Dale Emery called Resistance is a Resource, and if people are wanting to... because it's really about how do you overcome resistance. There's that kind of idea that people resist change. I don't think they resist change. We all embrace change and we all try new things, but we're also reluctant to accept changes that involve risk for us, that are going to make us look bad, that might cause us to fail, that are scary. And we don't like those kinds of changes. Yeah. And we also don't like... you know, we get very comfortable with doing things a certain way. So when someone comes in and says, well, you should try this, it's like, well, yeah, people say that to me all the time. How do I know that this thing is going to be the thing that really changes that? So when I go in and work with teams, things that help is having someone that is a champion for that thing and is willing to kind of do a lot of the initial legwork in educating people and showing them that it's not as scary as it looks, right? And then I can come in and support that person or those people by providing training, helping raise awareness, telling people that it's not as scary as it looks, and there are lots of other people already doing this and succeeding, and be able to tell those stories, right? Because people need to hear that when they're starting something. They want to hear that it actually works, and it's not just this wacko kind of thing that someone inside the company is, you know, it's the latest practice du jour that they're being pushed to do, forced to do. So I think part of it is a bit of evangelism in a positive sense, education, helping people know that there are success stories and being able to hear those, trying out something, treating it as an experiment so it's not a scary thing. And I think that's true for any kind of change, right? Whether it's adopting a new framework or a new language, is putting people in an environment where it's safe to be able to... Like, if you want to improve, you have to be willing to make mistakes and fail.
Now, this is sounding really weird. We've had to come back after a little, let's just say, a malfunction.
Technical issue.
Yeah, technical issues.
Recording issue.
Yeah, what they used to have on TV, where they used to come up with a little dancing man going, we'll be back in a moment, or something like
that. That's right.
Yeah, there you go. So before we really interrupted, the last question I had for you was, DDD, it's you and I know it's been around for a long time. We've read the book, right, 10 plus years ago. Do people see it as an old thing and perhaps that they... you know, the Kia ora kāinga, still trying to push it around, or is it actually still seen as something new and exciting and ready to solve problems that we've got?
So it might be a little bit of selection bias, because I teach a lot of introductory, like, domain-driven design classes. So it's definitely, most of the people I work with is something new. But then at the same time, within, like, the DDD conference that we had in Brussels earlier this year, and at the DDD Exchange in London, at these conferences, there are a lot of people there that have been doing this for a long time. So
it's evolving, right?
Yeah, and it is evolving. It's changing.
About it.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of interest more recently in the last, 5 years or so, around event sourcing and CQRS and new architectural style. Well, it's the same old ideas that are being recast in new ways and being reintroduced. So now that we have, massive distributed systems, large amount of data, being able to come up with architectural approaches that can deal with that, and I think a lot of that is encouraging people to look at things like domain-driven design again, because DDD gives you a really good conceptual framework for being able to understand how to do these things that are often just considered to be very technical and nothing to do with domain modeling at all. And yet I really am convinced that how you conceive of the business domain, how you model that conceptually, and how you do that in your code is critical to doing good strategic design and understanding things like, if you're doing microservices, what should your boundaries be? How do you handle the communication between those services? If you're passing messages around, then what do those messages actually represent conceptually? Are they events? Are they commands? How do you translate those conceptual things from one context to another. Like, all that is at the heart of what you're thinking about when you're doing domain-driven design. And it's so easy to get caught up in the technical infrastructure aspects of it that you forget about what you're actually doing in terms of trying to solve the business problems.
Mm. Well, I do love that you're, I guess, as a coach, you found that niche that bridges those things together, that you've got the BDD, the DDD, and the agile partner brings together all the different parts from the business to the analysts, to the testers and developers.
Yeah, and that's always been something that I've cared a lot about, is how do I do things that are going to bridge that gap, that's going to get the developers out of their shells and actually interacting with the people in the business and providing them with a set of thinking tools and skills that will engage the people from the business, because a lot of times in agile teams they're told, well, just collaborate with the business, but they're not really told what that looks like. Mm. and they're not really given any skills for that. And I think these types of things like domain-driven design, BDD, I really see them as different forms of collaborative design. And so that's something that I want to be focused on, is how do we do design in a collaborative kind of way with the business? And I don't think that's going away. I mean, there'll be trends within Agile that will come and go, but I think the notion of how do we bridge that gap between the business and the technical people is always going to be a big part of that. And how do we provide those same tools can help the business people actually interact with the technical people without having to feel like they have to learn all the technical jargon that goes along with that.
Mm. So it's been great talking to you. If people want to know more, I mean, you're around the world talking about this, where can they find out more about you and all the things you talk about?
Best place to find out about me is through my company. So if they go to www.virtualgenius.com.
Awesome name, by the way.
Thank you. And I'm hoping in the coming months to get more of my talks and stuff online so that we can put more of that virtual aspect in there and be able to provide some online learning and things like that. And there's connections there to my blog. And if people are interested in classes, then there's information about what kind of classes I teach. So it's a nice way to do that. And I love coming in and helping companies and teams get better at doing collaborative design.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And it's great to see. How long have you been in the US now?
16 years.
16 years, and that Australian accent, mate, is still there.
Yes.
I was worried. I haven't seen you for about 5 years, and I went, it's going to be more. It's going to be more.
I fully expect that every time I come back to Australia, they're going to say, oh, you talk like an American now. But some people seem to pick it up more than others. So I had a friend that moved from Perth to Texas. 6 months later, she sounded like she'd lived there her whole life. I was like, what happened to you? Did they put you in some kind of camp and language camp or something?
You must have missed that up in the mountains.
I don't know. So yeah, it's good to be back. And
so we like to say you're flying the Australian Agile flag over in the US for us.
Yeah, and what I'm hoping to do is to have more opportunities to come back to Australia and kind of help people to learn more about these kind of techniques and be more aware of it and be able to get the benefits of it.
Awesome. So we've got one last thing. At the end of the podcast, we always end by saying, Viva la Revolution, because this is an agile revolution.
Oh, yes, of course.
So you can help us out with that on the count of three. One, two, three.
Viva la Revolution.